Light is all around us. From the morning's first rays of sun to the waning glow of a crescent moon. From the torches of our ancestors to the glowing screens of our mobile devices. Light is our guide, our timekeeper, and our guardian. Light shows us where to go and how to move. It teaches us how the world works and how to react. It helps us comprehend our reality. It lets us see. And there's nowhere where this is more apparent than when you're at a concert, listening to your favorite band, and the lighting designer is firing on all cylinders.
Yo, welcome to season two of the Light Side Podcast. You like how I did that? I just didn't put out an episode for a while, and now we're in season two. It's amazing how that works. Before we dig in deep on this one, I've got some exciting news to announce. Grandanime 3 is here. Woo! We're excited. In fact, as I record this message, they're actually debuting the consoles today in Germany at Pro Light and Sound. So if you have not heard of these wonderful new machines, check them out at grandanime3.com. As far as our end of things over here at Luke Stratton Design Headquarters, we've been getting a bunch of questions about, is there going to be a command keyboard for MA3? Will my LPC work with MA3? The answer is yes, as much as we can. We're definitely doing a command keyboard. We're going to port all the main LPC products, and we're going to be probably launching one or two new ones as we get our hands on the software. Also, keep in mind that if you are in the United States, we are an MA dealer, and we are accepting pre-orders now for all the MA3 product line, as well as MA2 stuff. Head over to LukeStrattonDesigns.com for info. Pricing is going to be up. As of this recording, I can't put it up yet because it's not public, but it should be up very soon, maybe by the time you hear this. Other than my endless self-promotion of all my various projects, The Light Side is a ad-free podcast, so consider donating over at patreon.com/thelightside. And finally, the third episode of Lighting Director's Commentary, the YouTube show hosted by myself and MK Devo, should be dropping soon. Episode 3 features Blake Addington of Lettuce. My guest this episode is the legendary Candace Brightman, famed Grateful Dead lighting designer and director, as well as Widespread Panic, Traffic, Allman Brothers, a couple other artists over the years. But Candace is suffering from a rare condition called age-related macular degeneration, and she's basically slowly losing her eyesight. So you can imagine, for being such a beloved visual artist, how terrible that is for her and for the people who care about her. A few weeks ago, I reached out and said, hey, you know, Candace, I have this podcast. I'd love to have you on anyway, but I figure we can do a 1-2 punch here and maybe try to raise awareness for this fundraiser that people have started on her behalf. So if you are interested in helping Candace out, you can visit youcaring.com/CandaceBrightman-1085409, or you can just Google Candace Brightman, YouCaring, and donate and help her get the surgery that she needs. But without further ado, here is my hour and a half interview with Candace Brightman. I want to start at the very beginning, if we can. What's like the first memories you have of either working in the industry and being a designer, or even maybe before that, just manipulating light?
So the way I got started was that I was looking at the Village Voice for jobs, which is what we all did. And there was three available, and one of them was a cashier in the Anderson Theater. And so I went there to get the cashier job, but they'd already given that to somebody else. And I said, you got anything else? And they said, well, you could go backstage and talk to a guy named Chip, and maybe he'll find something for you to do. So I went back there, and that was what they were doing was rock and roll shows out of that theater, which I had no idea. I didn't know anything about it. And so Chip said, well, yeah, you want to do lighting? Sorry, but this is really how it started.
So you just got thrown in, yeah.
Yeah, and he was going to come and show me how this stuff worked, because which, you know, in those days, you didn't have to be shown anything, come to think of it. But I had never run lights for anything at all. I didn't know anything about it. And so then the night that where he was going to teach me, he never showed up. And I come to think of it, I think probably he was there the whole time saying, what the fuck is this little kid going to do? And so
how old were you?
Oh, 24, 20.
Yeah. Okay.
Young, 68. Yeah. 24. Yeah, or maybe even earlier. But anyway, it's hard for me to remember. It's always been hard for me to remember things. And so the band got on stage, and all of a sudden I thought, oh my God, well, I guess I just have to, I don't know what these different knobs do, but I hit a knob, and the band started playing really fast. I think it was a band called Pearls Before Swine. And they just dove into a tune, and I accidentally hit the bump button, so the whole stage went bright red. The light show people kind of looked around at me like, whoa, she really knows what she's doing. And so then I was like, oh, this is pretty straightforward. Apparently I've grabbed the circuit breaker rather than the dimmer. And these were all resistance dimmers. Now, do you even know what a resistance dimmer is?
You know, I have no idea. Please enlighten me.
Well, I don't either, really. But they dim by soaking up heat, basically. And so that they can get very hot. It's a very primitive concept. And there's handles. Dimmers had handles. So when I was starting, the way people would do something that was complex to light, say a Broadway show, or a musical where the lighting cues were all written out by the lighting designer, and then the stage manager calls them out. He's calling out the lighting cues to maybe, I really don't know, but at least four, maybe six union guys who are on headsets, and they're standing by their little rows of levers. Mm-hmm. There'll be six people just doing some little partial cues. So it just to let you know that how very different lighting was in those days.
So what was the next step after that first initial gig?
I started working there. I really liked the people, and I liked the sense of adventure and the humor. It was just, you know, I was like, what am I going to do? Am I going to work in an office? I can't work in an office. I was thinking of being a set designer because I had designed a set in college. And so then I did actually go to a school of set design for a while. But anyway.
What was the name of the theater?
That was the Anderson Theater. And it was right across the street from the Fillmore East.
Oh, okay.
And so I believe this guy Chip, whose name was Chip Monk, I think he and John Morris persuaded Bill Graham to come out from the Fillmore on the West Coast and open up this theater across the street, whose name, I forget what it was called, but anyway, then they renamed it the Fillmore East. So this little place where I was working was kind of a little hole in the wall, and then we all went across the street to the Fillmore East and put in a real beautiful lighting system. And that lighting system was designed by Chip Monk, and it seems to me that Chip's influences were more theater, possibly theater and dance. I'm not too sure. As far as I know, at that point, I don't think there was any rock and roll lighting. What they had.
So well, I mean, that's what I was thinking is the very, very beginning. So
yeah. So, you know, you could say, well, you either got me or nothing. No, I didn't say that. What was happening by way of visual entertainment was so much better than lighting, I think, in a way, because it's the light shows.
You mean like with oils and projectors?
Yeah, and all sorts of unusual things. Lumia, where you have a light reflected on a soft piece of reflective metal, so you can move it around, and that shape would move around over all the other things. And there's a group of people working together and each bringing in their... Anyway, I thought it was wonderful. I don't know why that dropped out, because actually that's a much easier thing to do than stage lighting, where you have to get lights all over the place. You know, you never knew what you were going to find in the theater when we were first traveling on the road.
Did you use any of that technique in your later designs?
What technique?
Where you're bouncing light
off. Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, you know, there was a period a little later on where it just drove us all crazy that we couldn't get lights that moved around and did stuff. I was ready to quit, I guess, around the 80s, get out of lighting, because I was so bored that you couldn't wiggle stuff around and put in different gobos. You know, it was frustrating. I could tell it was stupid. And somebody from Detroit came up with a light. There was one time I had one light that I could move around on a joystick. We were definitely ready for automated lighting, dying for it. I had gotten kind of bored with the fixed lights, which is silly because there's an infinite amount that you can do with any lighting system, fixed or whatever. But we are also happy when automated lighting sure. came. Imagine you guys who are listening to this just having Legos and power cans and using gel that sometimes burns up while you're during the show. And I don't know if I told you this, but I one time was lighting Carlos Santana, and he was doing this wonderful guitar solo, as he always does. And just as it got into the rippingest, most thrilling part of it, the gel burned up and the light went to white. That was unfortunate. There were other unfortunate things, like the sure. gel falling into Odetta's hair. That was bad.
So how did the Fillmore, I guess, transition you into, I guess, working for, what was the next big gig?
Oh, well, this is just too hard. This is too strange. But anyway, here goes. The Dead, the Grateful Dead, were coming to the Fillmore East. And I was like, God, the Grateful Dead, they're like really weird. And it's going to be all these strange people. And it just seemed sort of overwhelming. So I quit Fillmore. In order to avoid working with the Grateful Dead.
I could see that worked out for you.
It turned out that they were just, you know, I just felt so comfortable around them. Another theater was opening up in Portchester, which is...
The Capitol Theater?
The Capitol Theater, yeah, in Portchester.
Yes, I actually have shows there in 2 weeks.
Good. Oh, good. Peter Shapiro.
Yeah.
Has gone nuts with that place. And so so that was just, they were going to, Howard Stein was going to open that, and they needed somebody to do lighting. And a friend of mine, Bruce Bial, who's been immensely helpful to me in my life, said, oh, why don't you do this? And so had to do the installation, and, you know, order the cable from Parkside in Chicago, and just turn it into a lighting system, buy the lights, all that kind of stuff. And so that was great, because we had just done the Fillmore East. We just put that together, and I knew these superb people who did that for a living, who were technical directors and taught technical direction. So I would just ask what kind of thing I need for this and that, and I put that together, that theater together, pretty much myself.
So at this point, I'm thinking, hey, in a couple weeks, I'm going to be at the Capitol Theater. I should talk to Pete Shapiro and see what he says about working with Candace and about the Cap. Of course, Pete wasn't going to be there when I was there, so I got him on the phone.
There's lighting, and a lot of bands benefit from good lighting. And then there's kind of like the relationship that the Grateful Dead and Candace had, which... You know, her use, you know, of tempo and moods and And in those days, you know, kind of analog lighting, we didn't have all the digital LED stuff. It was an extra member of the band. It was a really important part of the whole experience. And I remember just from the first shows I saw, like, holy shit. You know, stadium show was my first show. And that was pretty heavy duty. The Capitol is a room, you know, listen, Pink Floyd and the Stones and Bowie and Derek and Domino's. We're very fortunate about all those bands. And like, but the band that really defined the venue is the Grateful Dead. They did 18 gigs in 11 months in 70 and 71. And it's curved. It's like a low for it's a 2,000 capacity room, and it's shaped almost like a planetarium. You know, today in 2018, we're doing kind of projection mapping and video wall, you know, crazy that stuff. But back in Candace's time in 71, when Grateful Dead were there, you know, she was using probably, you know, traditional lighting bar cans then. You see a lot of great lighting designers today, and they have so many toys that they get carried away sometimes, you know, and it becomes more about them and the light show. And like Candace is able to do a big light show, but keep it always about the music and the performers, I think, and augmenting them. She never kind of distracts, she augments. And that's like a massive talent to be able to do that. And you have all these toys at your disposal. You could even go another notch further. But she has that discipline, and I think that's because she learned her heyday. You know, she was doing it in a time when you didn't have all those toys. You didn't have these LED magic things. You know, using parkan lighting, it was like, you know, I think that really, you had to learn your skills the old-fashioned way. If you can learn those old-fashioned skills, and then you bring that into today, there's not a lot of people that can do that.
Bands used to stick around the Portchester Capitol. They would come in for sometimes 2 weeks and sort of get their act together for a tour. That was a really nice thing. So I got to know people. And then there really wasn't much lighting anywhere else. So people would ask me to go do Traffic of the Allman Brothers or Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Lest we forget, Bette Midler. I worked for Bette Midler. Oh, God. They'd come through and they'd say, well, can you do these shows? So I would do shows in Atlanta and Chicago and Detroit and, you know, the whatever arenas they were doing east of the Mississippi. So that's how it got started. I just started doing lights for individuals. And in those days, they didn't have, we're still in the 60s, I think, or early 70s. You'd get to an arena and there would just be follow spots. And in some places, I had a little stage plot. What you do, what I would do in the garden or, you know, in any of these big things is try to get about 25 follow spots. And there would be, you know, if they were super troopers, they'd be sidelight, or if they were just troopers. I just had gladiators and super troopers and troopers, and you would call a show, which,
Candace, are those kinds of lights?
Oh, yeah.
The gladiator and super trooper?
Yeah. Yeah. They were BMLs. Are you familiar with BMLs?
I'm not.
No, wait. What is it? Big fucking... BFLs, yeah, BFLs. They were big fucking lights, and which is a type of light. Are you familiar with the BFL?
You mean the ones you guys used a couple years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, the BMFL by Roby. Yes, I'm familiar with that light.
Yeah. Yes, okay. So these were very large lights. I mean, the Gladiator was 7 feet long and probably, I know, weighed at least 500 pounds. And so what you have is a lot of hollow spot operators, and you just put them, divide them up into groups, backlighting, side lighting, and a little front lighting, and then a couple guys would be the feature guys. So so that's one situation you get into, because you're going into just a building that was really meant for hockey and basketball, you know, and they didn't have anything. So that was exciting and very different. And also, when I first did it at the Garden, I didn't have feedback from the spot operators had headsets, but I just had a microphone, which apparently for some reason, the previous person, they told me that another person who had used this microphone was Walter Winchell. Now, I have no idea what that's all about, but just once again, to give you an idea of how we were going into a space that was completely empty of concert lighting, a world that had no concert lighting, either that you could rent or, you know, whatever. Fortunately, the PAR came in because and they also just about that time had ramped everything up to be 1,000 watts rather than 750.
So then how did you come in full time with the Grateful Dead?
Oh, well, I sort of got to be friends with them at the Porchester Theater, and I would spend a lot of time talking to Garcia. You know, he's such a good hang. There was an Intermounting Flame show being done in upstate New York, and I wanted to see that band. So I called the guy who was promoting it, and whose name was Phil Hack. Why I remember that, I don't know. But anyway, so he said, yeah, I'll fly you up here. And so that was my way of getting to see them for free. But then when I got there, the opening act was Jerry Garcia and Howard Wales, which is just, that's a wonderful band. That is a wonderful band. So then Jerry saw the lighting for Intermounting Flame. He came back and asked if I would work for them. They're about to do a European tour. So I guess this was the spring of 72. So I did. I asked him what it paid, which seemed to amaze him. And he said, well, some people work for us for nothing. And I said, well, not me.
Yeah.
I think he must have always known I wouldn't fall for that crap. But anyway,
yeah.
So
your first tour with the Dead was Europe 72.
Yeah. But then, you know, we had just done so many shows with them because we'd moved. Oh, that's right. We'd moved out of the Porchester Theater into the Academy of Music, which is now something or other, I've forgotten. And so the Dead spent 2 weeks there before they went off to Europe. So, yes, so that was 72. And it was Garcia that hired me, it was very interesting doing that tour because we're going to Europe and then we've got to do, you know, you have to use different dimmers, and the dimmers were not protected from sound in any way. So you could wrap things with copper wire and make the dimmers quiet. Otherwise, you would hear the dimming in the PA. This was a big deal, and it was very hard to do. And also, they had a kind of weird way of miking at that time, where the double miking thing. So that was all very...
Yeah, to eliminate feedback.
Yeah. And but anyway, that was always kind of a pain in the ass, but because, well, not just a pain in the ass, because you feel terrible if you're hearing dimmers in the, you know, I mean, that's terrible. That's a tough one. And then Europe, do we talk about Europe?
If you want, sure.
Well, the French didn't like a woman lighting designer.
Sure.
And they were terrible and impossible. And finally, I had to get my crew chief to appear to be the one who was doing the lighting.
Yeah, okay.
And they stole my tools, which were all marked with my name, and people would go through Europe, and for years later, they would find Candace's tools in Paris. In Germany, they were fine, and they were kind of stupid about English, which surprised me. and they treated me, you know, a little bit weirdly. And then at the end of the thing with my having to look in my book and speak German, after the whole thing was over, they all said, oh, well, it was a pleasure working with you. They had perfect English. And so there's a lot of, that's something that I've run into, is that there's a tremendous amount of teasing that goes on, which I suppose I got
sure.
plenty of.
I wanted to interject here because I'm not sure if you're aware, but today is actually International Women's Day.
Oh, no, cool.
I'm frankly honored to be interviewing one of the first, if not the first, female lighting directors. So, I mean, in segueing out of that bit with the Europeans,
yeah.
do you have any, can you talk a little bit about the specific challenges you faced as a woman designer and maybe some of the particular sour experiences you had, or maybe sometimes when you kind of showed the good old boys who was boss?
I didn't have much trouble being a woman in that job because I'm such a tomboy, I guess. I just felt like, well, this is what I'm doing, and I didn't think of it very much. I just did it, and sometimes I got trouble from the IA crew, but the overwhelming experience I got was that they would tease me, but that they were extremely kind to me. And
sure.
I didn't, and the thing is that I can start, you know, when I get near a union crew, we start laughing almost immediately. So I guess that was a big help because we just had so much fun at these gigs, that, you know, like I would go down to Atlanta all the time and, that crew, we really just loved each other. So, I've been trying to think of her name and I can't, but there's a woman I work with every once in a while who's just gorgeous. And as soon as she stopped moving or something, people would come to her, all the guys would come and say, can I help you? And I'd be over, you know, a few feet away lumbering around with something rather, no. But anyway, I did not run into problems until I actually started working for the Dead. And that's where the women thing was a real problem for their roadies were very backward. The union guys were hazing me, but that only meant that I was being led into the club. So that wasn't too hard for me to deal with. Whereas I think that the Dead Road crew, I don't really want to get into talking about them. And I like them very much. And they were the ones who couldn't get used to working with a woman. So that was odd. And I don't really want to dwell on it. They just never got it.
That's okay. Yeah. We can move on.
Sorry, that's the parrot next door, if you hear that screaming.
I do hear it. It's okay.
Yeah, well, that's good. He's behaving himself right now.
Can you talk about the next phase for the Dead? Because I feel like that was a very important phase for you because of the way the technology changed. Tell me about the 80s and about...
Okay, well, the 80s was just when the technology was changing. That's when they started introducing it. And I got it the instant I could. I mean, you know, within months after it.
Well, when you say it was the first thing that really changed your job.
Oh, Very Lights. Very Lights for, for another band that you probably know the name of, and I can't think of.
Genesis.
Genesis. Yeah, very good. Anyway, they got this stuff rolling and everybody, you know, instantly we were all renting it. And the control, so that was Very Lights, funded to create a light that had, an intelligent light. So out came those, and then everyone had to have them. Programming, it was very odd how you programmed. They were meant to do very simple things, and so getting them to do something, you had to pretend that everything they were doing, they were getting as a value, an intensity value on a light, you know. But in fact, what they were doing was they were getting the cyan gel rolled in, and it was analog. Initially, each light, I think, only had 10 functions, which would have been pan and tilt and intensity and six colors and something else, iris. You would just run those as channels, so you'd have to interpret your tilt would appear to be a three volts on a 10-volt fader. So we all had to be programming. I mean, they didn't have controllers for this gear yet. And I found that very interesting because I could do it. I don't know why, but I was able to do it. And it was really fun figuring out how to get this stodgy computer to do interesting cues. And I really enjoyed that. And I programmed my own stuff right up through 91. I didn't like, when the controllers got more so-called sophisticated, you could see less and less of what your lights were actually doing. Then they started trying to write more things for us. And then take that up to right now, or a few years ago, when the programming on the GMA, the Grand MA, which is what I like to use, or used to like to use, they had made the programming so complicated that you had to do, if you do this, then you have to be sure to make go over and make that happen. But if you do that other thing, then you have to go to this third thing. And I was just thinking, God, this is so dumb. I can write these cues on with anything. I guess it's fine for everybody else. Me, I like to sort of see what everything's doing.
Well, maybe it's what you get started with, because I started on Grand MA too. That's
how young I am, I guess. Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I know it very well. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, no, but I've always liked the Grand MA, and I programmed that. I just gradually got out of programming. I don't know why.
Does it have to do with meeting Paul Hoffman?
Well, no, actually it didn't. It had to do with meeting that horrible kid. And it's okay. He can hear that he's a horrible kid. Gumper.
Oh, Andrew Gumper?
Yeah. Well, he could write. He could somehow write up my shows really quick. And since I've been programming for myself for the first 10 years of it, other people would look at the program and go, what the hell is this? But I'd have, I had like 30 pages of programming I would do for, and I'd just put it in and the whole thing would be set. But anyway, somewhere along the line, somebody else started to take over, and I guess it was Andrew Gumper.
And would you say he's a horrible kid because he was so quick at it?
No. This is, oh, goody. Okay, yeah. Andrew, get ready for this.
Yeah, go. No, please let us have it.
Of all the people I ever tried to teach to do lights, the one who was the most frightened was Andrew Gumper. Isn't that amazing? I mean, he was like really nervous. I had to go to a wedding, and the show was an afternoon show. So, I mean, just getting into darkness. Anyway, he was kind of rough at it for about 10 minutes, and then he was fine. He's funny, though. I know he's a bad boy, but my God, his practical jokes are the best.
Do you have any examples?
Yeah, I do. He came into a show at Radio City, not some other show he was doing, didn't have anything to do with me. And he took a picture of the back wall of the theater, of the stage, the back wall of the stage, which is way back there. And so then they did this, they had a video wall. They're very proud of this wonderful new video wall they have, finally, at Radio City. And so they brought the video wall in, and they were playing stuff that Gumper had programmed. So Gumper gets on the headsets and says, oh, my God, where's the video wall? You guys, where's the video wall? What he has on the video wall is the photo of the back wall. New York, IA, yes, yes. And for some reason, they fell for it. In other words, you'd think they would look out sideways and see the wall, but they didn't. They just panicked. I don't know how long it lasted. I'll have to ask him. But that's my idea of heaven.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk about your design process. Can you maybe walk me through the beginning of a design that you might have, and all the forms that it goes through in your mind and then on paper, and then what it takes to become a reality?
Strangely enough, the first thing that I work with, which is probably not the best way to do it, but is a new rig. And I like the lighting rigs to feel like they already are in motion. I mean, I don't like verticals and horizontals. Also, I like asymmetry, although it's hard to work asymmetrically. I mean, you know, it's easier to make things look good if they're the same on both sides. They get a certain power. And I like the whole rig to feel like it's maybe just slightly ill at ease. And but not so you notice, just alive. There's a software that I can't remember that I was using in the late 80s and 90s. So you can just, I would just fiddle around with, you know, you can.
Well, it was like a CAD program?
Yeah, it's a CAD program. And, it was, anyway, so it's very easy to try things and then put lights on them and turn on the lights. And I mean, that's so easy now. But anyway, I would try to get something that was full of life and energy, not too static looking. And also part of that came from when I first started to do that, the lighting company that was supplying me the lights said, what are you doing? You know, that truss isn't level. Yeah, so that's the way I saw it. I was like, God, you guys, come on, let's shake it up a little bit. Yeah, so those truss designs, as you can see, everybody just has an absolute ball with them. But I personally would like to see a show still lit more like a film and less lighty, which is why I quit lighting in 2008, because I wasn't doing anything new with it. And it just seemed to me that it should feel like something very sweet was happening in the venue, or enormous. You know, there's not enough ways to express pandemonium. And just, you know, lights blinking on and off. Oh, my God. I just got to the point where I just thought, I have to quit. Although, you know, you have to have the lights. I mean, it's fun, you know. I love doing that. And I loved doing it with Widespread Panic. They were a lot more fun to light than the Grateful Dead. Or they were different. You could just really kick ass and let loose. And I really enjoyed that. But then, of course, I loved working for the Grateful Dead. And it was so nice once we got the good equipment. Then everybody was hooked. I mean, that was a dream.
Was it way different for you and maybe exciting for Fare Thee Well to light the Dead or a version of the Dead with newer equipment?
No, it wasn't newer. It wasn't anything new.
Oh, so you felt similar?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yes. In my opinion, that hasn't, well, I don't know what's going on now. I don't look at anything. I'm a bit of a hermit. But the equipment really, you know, it did its thing. And by 96 or 7, it all was in ship shape. And
but you're saying that the change from when you started to like 97 is much more dramatic than where it's come since then.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
Well, I'm saying that it's sort of the same as it was in the 90s to me. And I know that there's, you know, the equipment was much dimmer and it didn't have the accuracy and it didn't have all the apps. Each light didn't have so many different apps. And but still, I just felt like I was doing the same thing when there would be an intensity chase and then lights would fly around. And it's like, okay, we've seen that. So you can imagine how that would be if you've been doing that for 40 years.
Yeah, sure. There are times when I'm running shows and I really be like, aren't there any more colors? I feel like I've used all the colors.
Yeah.
Like, why aren't there more, you know?
Yes.
But scientifically, you know, there aren't more, you know?
Yeah. And but just something, it just should be something completely different. I mean, it's like, take all those wiggly lights, which is what Robbie Greenberg always called them, and don't even use them. I would like to, you know, imagine if you were seeing a band, you know, more like you would see them in a video, in a music video. On the other hand, when I go to somebody else's show, which I haven't been in a million years, but when I do, if they're not doing all those bells and whistles, I'm like, come on, dude, let's go, you know? So,
use the gear, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just flail away. Now, flailing away and not being inspired. I'd like to make a segue here.
Sure.
That everyone's going to go, ooh, and they hear what it is. Those times when you're not really flailing away, the music is perfect. And there's not very much going on in the lighting designer's mind it's bypassed the brain and gone straight through the computer and the hands out to the lights. You know, when you're doing lighting and it's so good and you're not doing it, you feel like somebody else is doing it. Do you ever have that happen?
I have had that happen. It's a wonderful feeling.
It's a wonderful feeling. You feel like, well, gee, maybe there's actually a God or something. I mean, it's like, this is, wow. And you just stand there, you know, and smile. And that happens to, you know, everybody, cooks and guitar players and everybody. You just imagine.
That's kind of what we're always going for, yeah.
Yeah. I remember one time doing a show, and the guitar player for the show came out and said, I'm sorry, what did we do to you? We did something very bad. Because I had all the, it was, they got some amazing pot on stage, and then that goes right down the snake to us out front, and we get hit with these things. And you don't know, you know, it's like a really good show that's really up and sort of screaming can just kind of take you over, and you don't even know what you're doing. And that's a very nice thing when that happens.
Absolutely.
That's really cool. That's the best. Yeah. I'd love to hear more. Yeah, and I should listen. Has anyone else talked about that moment?
Oh, yeah. Chris Kuroda is really fond of that concept.
Yeah.
He's a big admirer of you, by the way.
It's mutual.
But I think that's kind of what we're all going for.
Yeah.
We're all going for that moment of zen, if you will.
Yeah.
And for me, as a very intensive programmer as well, it's hard to, like, stop thinking about how you program the show and just run it.
Yeah.
You know, and just click in with the moment
instead
of like, oh, this position isn't perfect.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
That color wipe wasn't in the right order, you know.
Sometimes for me, what was hard was just that sometimes I just didn't seem to have it in me. But then usually my feeling about that was that with the Dead, there was lots of times when the show just didn't seem to feel like it was really happening. And that doesn't happen so much with Widespread or other bands. You know, they just get on and kick.
Do you mean that it wasn't happening on stage, or it wasn't happening for you from a lighting perspective?
Yeah, it wasn't happening both. That, as though one can't be separated from the other sometimes. When a really,
sure.
when a show that seems really awkward is coming down the snake, yeah. Me and whoever is doing sound would sometimes look at each other like, oh God.
Yeah.
I have never been able to pull one of those out of the fire, and I try really hard, but I can't do that.
Okay, well, I guess if cutting back to some more discussion of your designs, you were talking about the whole flowy aspect, and I noticed that you used throughout your career a lot of circles, and I wonder if you could talk a little about using circle trusses and the role that they've played and how you think about putting projection inside of them and that kind of thing.
Well, it's great that everybody's doing this, projecting the video in the circle is the most elegant thing you can put it into. Originally, I put it into something that was more of a video ratio, which is an oval, but circles really kick ass, and they look so good. They look wonderful in Paul Hoffman's, you know, they're just like, just very intense and very much a part of the show. And it's, that's so cool to see that. Mm-hmm. It, for me, I had to put them, someplace out of the way because the Dead roadies needed to be able to see the band at all times while still sitting backstage in their little, what we used to call condos. So I never could get a set down to the floor. So flying stretch surfaces, yes. And then the doing the summer ones was so, that was a breakthrough, I guess. The triangle is such a lovely, easy thing to work with. And you can, it's easy to rig. It takes wind really well. And so I was just trying to make a lot of little surfaces that take wind well so I could project on them. That's what those outside sets were. And that was really cool because we would take one of those sets that would be, you know, like one of them was 300 feet wide and actually went off into the bleachers on one side. And however high, 50, 60 feet high, I had a lot of drops painted in sort of pale colors. We could stuff them all into a road box. And we could do a show of that size with like 12 road boxes. That was 300 feet wide by 60 feet tall because it's just fabric. So that's really cool because we didn't have the budget. I had an incredible budget considering how that my lighting cost the Dead more money than other bands' lighting because other bands would go out for 6 or 8 months and the Dead would only go out for 2 or 3 weeks. Me and Jerry tried to get them to stay out. We really wanted them to just go out and do a few months and then get done and then go do something else. But they didn't. So you can't amortize a lighting plot over 16 or 18 shows and do very well. You know, what you need is 180 shows. They really did sort of put out, but still there was tremendous limitations.
So when you're directing a show, and you're thinking about color or colors, does the color come out of the song for you, or are you kind of more of a lighting the mood of the moment, and it could be different from night to night? Or do you kind of like, oh, I know that this song is these colors? Can you just maybe talk about your relationship with color and how you tie it in with music?
Well, I don't program. I just program bits and pieces. So when I'm running a show, you know, you don't like say, okay, we're doing Not Fade Away or something, and so all of these cues are set up. I always, yeah, there's no set way to light any one. And if there might be a way that I want to light something, I often can't because I just lit something else that way. So it gets pretty random. And it's more just timing. To me, I guess my favorite thing about lighting is timing. And then the actual look of it, I mean, the look is important too, but timing is just wonderful. I don't have any set thing, and I love it when I can do something different. If I'm starting to get into doing something a set way, it would be good if I could do something, stop doing that. I don't like to do the same things, except for some of the sort of gags that I used to do. One thing that came to me as a thing that needed to happen was this song called Playing the Band. And they get to the instrumental part of it, and it just, to me, it seemed as though the whole tune just floated out the back of the room. And then we were in this very abstract, spacey stuff, and I would like the whole room to be dark. So before Wiggly Lights in Madison Square Garden, I put a rows of lights over the audience. Then I was able to have the lights leave the stage and go through the audience and out the back. This is just with fixed lights. But it was wanting to do that cue that made me do it that way. It's not too conscious. I just try to make sure that I have enough bells and whistles and hopefully have written some new things. I'm always doing that. And sometimes when I've been a little rude to people coming up and talking to me before a show, sometimes right before a show, I'm writing something. You know, some idea has finally come to me. So, I just want the tools, and then it's all spur of the moment.
Yeah, kind of like the band in that case. Both Widespread and the Dead, you're just kind of going with the current vibe.
Yeah, Widespread are a lot easier to light than the Dead were. And lighting the Dead when they were doing the shows 2 years ago, the Fare Thee Well shows, that was extremely difficult because there had been so little rehearsal that I was thinking, I kept anticipating cues, and I couldn't do that thing where you look at somebody's eyes or you look at their hands or, I used to be able to tell 2 songs ahead of what they were. They were in the middle of one tune, I could hear the next tune coming, and sometimes I could hear the one after that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And really, and so doing those shows, there were no hints. There was just people staring at each other intensely. And it was really hard. Yeah. You know, there's none of those usual cues, somebody walking up to their pedal, somebody going back, you know, just the visual turning up, you know, none of that.
Well, yeah, and it's a different group of people than maybe what you're used to.
Yeah.
That has to be a challenge.
Oh, God. And Trave. Oh, he was so lovely. What a lovely guy. What an absolutely lovely guy. And I'm sure. Absolutely.
Did you guys interact much from a creative perspective?
No. Actually, I had a guy doing the lights, illuminating the band members on stage from a different controller. And I took my controller and went out back and built a tent over myself because they had the sound was within 100 feet of the stage. And I'm lighting for 300 feet away from the stage. And so I just went out back and then made sure someone who could actually see the stage a little better than me was lighting it. I just wanted to do the fluff.
So how about like before the show, like in both for those Fare Thee Well shows and also your career with both Widespread and the Dead, who of the bands would have creative input on how the rig should look and how you're lighting each night? Or were you totally left to your own devices in all three scenarios?
Totally left to my own devices.
Sure.
One time I was talking to Garcia about the rig and I don't know where, I don't even think we were in the building, but anyway, and then he drew the lighting rig. It's like, it's so typical. He just drew it like as though he'd memorized everything from the front.
And was it accurate?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was. And so his, I guess I was asking him, I don't know if it was this particular conversation or some other, but I was asking him if he had any ideas about lighting. And he said, yes, I think you should use brown lighting. I don't see much brown. And that's the extent of that.
I love that.
Yeah. Couldn't get him engaged on that subject. No.
How about you? Do you have a favorite color that maybe is like your go-to?
Oh, color. Yeah. Color. Just, I like fresh, really fresh color. I like sort of sharp yellow greens and yellow and turquoise, kind of clean colors. And what I use too much of, according to everyone that's ever worked with me, too much magenta, Brightman, they say. And
I am very equally guilty of
really?
Too much magenta. Well, it's one of those colors that I'm like, I don't love it, but it goes with everything that I do.
Yes,
I use it all the time.
Yes. And right. And then if you're at one of those points where it seems like that's all you've got is cyan, and I mean, yeah, you can. Yes. So, Robbie Greenberg, you're right. Everybody else is right. Paul Hoffman, you're right. Too much magenta. No more magenta coming from me. I'm done. No particular colors. I like black and white. I wish there was a way to do black.
Yeah, me too.
Light.
Like to suck light out of somewhere. That'd be on.
Yes. That'd be wonderful. When they do this tune called The Other Ones, what I was thinking about that one day, and then I just knew, of course, what it should be, a Dowser chase, which is no big deal, except that it came to me in like 88 or something, and that was another cue that just, you know, where you just see what it wants to be. Oh, and can I tell you something else? How to find new things. One of the way I like to find new things, new lighting looks, is take the patch for one lighting look. Like I usually have them available on faders. So mix and match with a look that's meant to go on certain faders, but try it on a set of faders that's programmed for another look. And then also definitely getting the people who are your programmers to play. We would, at the beginning of a tour, always have a night where I encouraged heavy drinking and drugs, and then everybody would just play. And then we got wonderful cues out of that.
Some of the coolest stuff probably showed up, right?
Yeah. Playing, if you can just kind of let stuff be random, is really cool. I remember at one point I was actually working on something that would just do random lighting, but I never got there. Another thing that I think might be a very good lighting tool. And I tried it once, and it has a very powerful effect on the audience, is to connect up your whatever you want. In my case, I did it with tilt. I connected it up to Phil's bass. And so the lights were moving up and down, you know, with the bass. What was the problem? And it really, it shouldn't have been a problem because I could have just had a recording. But it was hard to learn to use it live. And it would have been nice to, and it never really got hooked up until after sound check. But it's the kind of thing where you'd want to rehearse with the band using that, those tools. And we were always kind of sneaking those things in on them, sure. You know. It gets a powerful reaction, especially, I think, if you do it pretty subtly, or you just ease it, you sort of sneak it in until people finally realize, oh, my God, this is being controlled by this bass note or this drum. It's really exciting. Now, are people doing that? And I just haven't seen it because...
I think so. I've messed around with it a little bit. It can be random, I feel like, but you're saying that that's the beauty of it.
Well,
so I'm sure, I know a lot of video guys do that where they build in, you know, reactors so the video responds to certain frequencies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they must. And I think it's really cool and it's not that difficult. So I think that's a really good idea, but it should be, you know, it shouldn't be like follow the bouncing ball or something. It has to be a little bit subtle.
Yeah.
And
it has to be and smoothed a bit. That's the tricky part.
Yeah. That would have been really, that would have been a fun thing to start using. I mean, cause that opens up your possibilities tremendously. If you can assign color events or intensity events or whatever to that, and then dial them back a little bit if it's too much, like if you can, I think you can do this with color now. I like to run a lot of things on the controller, like the speed of a cue. A cue doesn't really have a speed. It's run on a fader, which addresses all pans and tilts. And I think that most people don't do that. They write things into cues and things are meant to go in a certain sequence. And I run those things live. And the speed of an intensity chase and all that kind of stuff, I run live. And it's not hard to do that. If, you know, like I would have a, if you have a, even if you have a couple of consoles, I got used to it. I had the color, with the Dead, I had the color console in front of me and then the very light console and then the, another console. And so there'd be three, and I didn't have any trouble with that, I guess. And people kind of go, Jesus, you know, how do you do this? This looks ridiculous.
Three controllers,
but, but it was just not until somebody pointed out to me that the keypad on one controller was upside down from the keypad on the other controller. So then I went through a horrible period of getting used to. Anyway, whatever.
But you hadn't realized up to that point?
No, I hadn't. Some asshole came up and some wonderful asshole.
Was it Gumper?
No, it wasn't Gumper. No, it was a much finer person than Gumper.
Sure. Yeah.
Well,
I guess with the control systems in mind, maybe we can segue to maybe more of a little nerdy technology section here. Do you remember, I mean, we kind of talked about the dimmer handles, but do you remember your first real controller? Was that the, what's the first real controller that you had that was a moving light controller, not just faders?
Well, I guess it was the, no, it wasn't Fairy Lights. Ah, okay. Yeah. For a long time I was using a lighting company called Morpheus Lights. And they, as soon as the wiggly lights came out, they built their own wiggly lights and their own controller. This is still in the analog age, which was nice because later on when I tried to use the controller that the Very Lights used, it was like they just assumed that a lighting operator couldn't do anything. I mean, they didn't leave anything for you to, you know, to affect what you were doing. Morpheus controller was real, it was a treat for me because it was easier to access and it was made for automated lights and I could get it to do things. Like the guy who ran the company would sometimes come out to his show and I think this is bragging. And he would say, how do you even get them to do that? That's the kind of programming. This controller was a, you know, it was the big physical controller with the faders. And then there was a part and it had a screen. And so it was actually the most sophisticated Wiggly Light controller, in my opinion, that was out at that point, even though it was put out by a very small lighting company with not the backing of the other.
So were you a big fan of the MA-1?
Yeah.
When you got your hands on it?
Yeah, I was. And I liked that thing right away. I was at the lighting show, and I went over to that controller, and I stood there, and I fell in love with it. It wasn't actually doing anything. But there was something about the way it was laid out that was just bingo, perfect, wonderful. And then as it got more and more powerful, I guess you could say, it got less and less interesting to me because it would say, oh, no, you can't do something that way. You have to, you know, it was, anyway, so that was a really good controller, but they didn't really realize when that one came out, they weren't aware of so many lighting people who were not writing cues in advance, of so much live programming. And then I think they got a little bit better at that, and then it got worse. So I'm not crazy about that thing from 2 years ago. I'm not so crazy about it, and I've noticed that some people, if you get back then, if you get online, they would be saying, well, now what? How are we supposed to do this? You know, so they did something. Of course, these things get updated, you know, like your phone gets updated and your computer gets updated and the control console gets updated. So at the beginning of a tour, one time, I was using the Grand MA and the show started and I was going along and then all the cues that moved from one place to another just went boom on a bump. Everything went on a bump. All the motion was just on a bump. And they had decided that you shouldn't be able to run speed on a fader, but you know, they don't tell you that. And so, so during the show, I had to, you know, get into a whole lot of these motion cues and give them time. Anyway, that's just one of those stories where the things you have to do during a show to make it work.
Do you remember what console you were using in 1988? This is a specific request for a listener.
I think it was I'm sure it was a Morpheus controller. I liked their controllers. Do I know which one? I mean, there were a few, but I liked those. But did they have Pan Command? Pan Command was the first. I don't know what I was using later on.
Gotcha.
In the 80s.
Can you talk a little about how when the moving light showed up? I know there's like a specific story and maybe you can recount it for us about where you were using moving lights and forgot to turn them off. I believe this was during a Terrapin station. Is this sound familiar?
Yes. That cue.
Can you tell us that story?
Oh, it's so sweet. It was a mistake. It used to be that I would program the lighting. The guy I was working with didn't actually program lights. And then I would run the fixed lights and Danny would run the wiggly lights. So somehow or other, yeah, we were doing Terrapin with all this lovely dramatic, then going to the next cue. But these cues, the lights would show up in the air and then there'd be a pause and then the lights would show up in another focus and then they'd show up in another, but they weren't moving from one focus to another. So by accident, we moved them from one place to another. Both of us were like, oh my God. And so I was very timid with lights initially. I didn't want to interrupt. I didn't want to be, I thought the dead didn't need anybody telling people how to react to their music. And so it took me a long time to get into realize that I should be more entertaining. And another person who helped was Freddie Hahn. Have you ever heard of Freddie Hahn?
No.
I think he's got something called the Art Police in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you need something absurd to happen, you just call the Art Police and in 20 minutes they'll come over and make something crazy happen. Well, so he came up to me one time and he said, you know, me and my friends refer to the Grateful Dead shows as sensory deprivation shows.
Before you started moving the lights?
That's a good question. Right about that time. It did take me a while with the moving lights to realize that what was preferred was not that I be quiet and let the great band do its own thing without being distracting lighting. That's how it started. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, my God, no, it's just the opposite. Anything goes. And and it took me a horribly long time to understand that.
I mean, but you're also kind of like inventing that style. Like you didn't have like other concerts to go watch that happen, right?
Oh, no, it was stupid. I was just, for some reason, for someone who's kind of a loud and obnoxious person, I was too cautious about that. It was the role that I thought I should be playing with bands. And that actually, so I did some really dull lighting for the first decade or two, and then I understood it, and then it was just tremendous fun. Isn't it? So much fun.
So much fun. I wonder if you can settle a debate the internet is having. Is it true that you and or Gumper owned Graname serial number one?
I think that would have to be, that would have to be Gumper.
But it's a good chance that if it was his, you might have used it, right?
No.
Or did the band own an MA?
No, I did.
Oh, okay.
It's a great idea. I recommend this to all you young people out there. Choose a controller that's kind of rare that you can't do without, and then buy it, and then rent it to your buddies, because,
your buddies being your clients?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've always done that.
It's a great move. That's what I do.
Yeah, and that's how I acquired some of the first electronic dimmers, which somebody had to make for me. You know, I had these control consoles, a lot of control consoles that somebody had made for me. And I had one that worked really well, except every once in a while it would just black out. So I had to stop using it. But a lot of our stuff was homemade, you know, the controllers at first. Not homemade, but, you know, made by a friend. So, you know, because the lights could do what they could do sort of before the control was so sophisticated.
Do you still have your MA, your first one?
No, I've sold them. I sold them. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I got the little one first. And then you do with the MA, you know, you always, I guess you do this with all control consoles now, but I always had the little one running the same show as the big one. And I had the big one programmed so it could go over into just those 10 faders. Yeah. And that is a really nice thing. Now, another thing about these controllers is that when I would use an auto transformer, which was what just preceded the electronic dimmers, I never was worried about anything going wrong. You know, these are big, old, you know, they weren't deep. It was pretty simple. So that's one sort of exciting aspect about lighting now is that the most amazing things can go wrong. And you just have to deal with it. I mean, lots of things have gone wrong. All the color, I've had colors go, I've had lights go gradually and ask people to take some PAR cans that were in the rig and put Edison plugs on them and plug them into the wall because I could see the lighting was just dropping out. That's something that is terrible when things go wrong, but it's very funny. I mean, it is very funny. And I noticed that people in the business really laugh while they're frantically working to fix things.
Well, I was thinking that could segue into the next thing I wanted to talk about. We were talking about doing a new feature on this episode called Horror Stories.
Yeah.
Which you and I discussed on the phone. And so what I want to do here, we all have those stories of those days when things just don't go right. And you and I both, we want to hear from the listeners as to the worst days on the job or maybe a funny experience you've had. So I've set up an email. You can email us at ldhorrorstories@gmail.com. And I'll make sure Candace and I will both get a copy of the email and we can read these lovely stories. But I think, Candace, do you have any lovely horror stories of days on the job that just went terribly wrong?
The worst thing, I think, is when your console just turns off and everything goes black. And it's strangely, it's a very quiet, you notice how quiet the lights are, or how they've made no sound, but they're completely obliterated. One was a show at the Fillmore where I don't remember who the band was, but they didn't like anything about the lighting. And the lighting was just the same. I mean, there wasn't anything. And they were complaining, and finally they said, could you please just turn all all the lights off? Well, that didn't really have anything to do with me. I wish I could remember. It was a good band, kind of a jazz band. Anyway, okay.
How about, do you have any good Jerry Garcia or band member stories, maybe specifically related to lighting? Although I think we kind of already touched on the lighting side. I have to ask for the token Jerry story.
Okay, well, we're going to get a token Phil story.
Token Phil story is great.
Yeah. When I was first doing lighting for them in 68 or 69, one of the things I thought was really nice to do for certain kinds of music was to turn all the lights off. Sometimes when it was just pandemonium, I would like to turn them off, but mostly when they just went into one of their really spacey periods, the Grateful Dead. And so a couple of things happened there. I did it with other people besides the Grateful Dead, and somebody's manager came racing up and wanted to know what was wrong, and I had to tell him there was nothing wrong. And then, so I used to like to have the lights out sometimes. I still like that idea. And so Phil, I heard indirectly, or he was complaining to somebody else, and I heard him. He said, I have to go put LEDs in my bass because I can't fucking see what I'm doing. He didn't seem to mind. But without telling me, he had his bass wired up so that he could see what he was doing in the dark. It hadn't occurred to me that that could be a problem. But I don't think it actually was a problem. I never noticed it was a problem for anybody before. People seemed to kind of like it. One of the things about Garcia that I noticed when I was first working with him was how very, what a cool customer he was. And one time he and I were walking somewhere through the auditorium theater out, you know, not backstage, but out in the house. And there was a policeman coming along, and Garcia had a joint in his hand, and he didn't stop talking. He didn't do anything. He just twirled the joint so it was facing into the palm of his hand rather than out of it. Now, that's not a very interesting story, is it?
I find it very interesting, but
he was very funny in a way that I just loved. He also believed that you couldn't be too silly. I would sometimes apologize for being too silly, and he would always say, you can never be too silly. Never.
Can you tell me about the relationship of psychedelics in your life and in your creative work?
You mean doing lights on acid?
Yeah, or like in your personal life and then how they influenced your designs. I just like, were psychedelics, I mean, you're the Grateful Dead's LD, like were the psychedelics, was that a big part of your life or not so much, you know?
Well, it was wonderful that we always got the first rate acid.
That's the kind of answer I'm looking for.
Yeah, that was really great. And I remember one time early in the morning when John Scher, who was a promoter on the East Coast, are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
Anyway, he was the East Coast promoter. And I was leading the promoter and some other people to the place to check in, at National Airlines. And I was leading them because they had become incapable of navigating an airport. And somehow we all decided that I was the one who was capable. And and we were all tripping. And but I marched right up to the Avis counter, which looked to me just like the other, National Counter, because they're both red, you know, their logo is red. So I had us trying to check into this plane on the ground level at the Avis.
At the rental car place?
At the rental car place, yes.
Yeah.
And so, and those were really joyful moments. And there was lots of times when we would fly, when we would be way, way out there. Like we'd take, like with the Garcia band, we'd take, that had the two, these two little jet planes, and we would do barrel rolls in them and stuff. And you can actually do a barrel roll without getting wine. The wine will stay in your glass if the pilots know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But you mean, as far as designing, as far as the look of it is concerned, not really. It didn't affect the look, but man, it sure affected the being at work. And I had to kind of stay away from that. But there were initially the unions, or especially the Chicago union, really, you know, they liked in those days to think of themselves as real tough fellows, and they insisted that they run the lights. We're, you know, all me and the roadies, who, you know, I got along with fine, unless they were just totally fucking with me. And we decided that, so there was this guy who was definitely going to run the lights, a union guy. And we're like, okay. So we gave him a control console, which was not my control console. And we set him up off to stage right or left and dosed him. And he went wild during that show with lighting. He got teased about that for decades after that happened.
But he was actually running the show, though. It was hooked up.
No, he thought he was. I was running the show. We had him down by the side of the stage. And Tokyo Joe Shapiro, I think that's what we called him. Maybe his name was Joe Shapiro. Tokyo Joe. I don't know. I can't remember what we call him. But anyway, but I don't approve of dosing people. And that did happen. But this guy.
I was going to say, did the Merry Pranksters or whatever get to you during the show?
They got to me one time. I was doing a show with a lighting company I'd never worked with before. And they were very pompous. L.A. La-di-da lighting company. And so they came out, and it's San Bernardino, doing a thing in San Bernardino. And so I got dosed. Somebody dosed me. And so I can't see the stage. All I see is all these colors and everything. So I got on the headset and asked the guy if he could come out and run the show for me. And he said, because I had gotten dosed and could no longer see the stage.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that's not very professional. And I said, well, I don't think it's very professional to run the show if you can't see the stage. I mean, I really did.
Yeah.
And then he came out and he was all grumpy and mad, and I don't know what he did. I just got my purse and kind of kept my purse near me and went backstage and laughed for the next.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. But anyway, he was so pompous, and he totally didn't get it. Stuff would really happen. Strange stuff would happen.
I just think it's interesting, you know, you would think, I think from the outside perspective, that the Grateful Dead LD, that, you know, psychedelics is a big part of that. But I think that the fact that it's work, you know, and people want to have their straight head on it, that's more important, you know. That's how it seems.
Yeah. I found that when I used to drink, and I quit in 84. And then Paul Hoffman got me started again a few years ago. And God, did we, God, there's a man who knows how to drink. I would like to tell anyone who's in the lighting business who gets anywhere near Paul Hoffman to try to give him as rough a time as possible. He likes insults, and he really likes it when you offer him a drink right in the middle of a show. And so. Don't give him any slack, because he can handle it. Okay, no. Where were we? Drinking. Yes. I had this feeling back when I used to drink that I couldn't do a show if I wasn't drunk. But then one day I decided that, you know, it was time to just quit drinking altogether. And so then I did the shows, and I found that and I thought I would be too nervous and everything. And I wasn't at all. But I lost the ability to be able to tell so far in advance what they were playing, what they were going to play. I became much more, some door closed, some little door closed that really was open.
Sure.
And, but of course, it's much better because there's so much to think about. There's just so much to think about.
This is a very technical job.
Yeah, it is. Yes. And you have to, and you have to worry about wind safety and, you know, that was a wonderful breakthrough. And then, Paul said, well, he heard that I, you know, did some very bizarre things when I was at, when I used to drink on the road, which I did because that's the most fun thing you can possibly do, I think, is misbehave in motels and hotels. But anyway, it's what you can't really do lighting drunk. I mean, that's really stupid. But I always kind of wished I could be slightly high, you know exactly why, just so you're even more present.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of on the wavelength of the audience, you know.
Absolutely, because I'm, you know, like a lot of women, I get really high on nothing, and then I'm just kind of useless. And so when we were doing the shows at the arenas, and the sound console guys, they always had a sofa right in front of me, and so, sometimes I would have to send somebody down there to ask them to please not smoke pot on that sofa.
Yeah, sure.
I felt so bad. You know, what? That's terrible. But anyway, sometimes it was, you know, it can get to be too much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
of course.
I'm sure everyone else who's listening to this is going, oh my God.
No,
you idiot.
I'm the same way. I don't smoke, so.
Yeah.
Makes me too weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got a cool section here, a segment here we always do on the show called the Strobe Round. So I'm going to read you off a bunch of questions, and you can answer them as fast or as detailed as you'd like, but they're not all lighting questions. Some of them are more fun.
Okay. So,
are you ready?
No. Go.
Okay. Do you have a favorite Dead show that you've worked?
No, I don't. I okay. definitely don't.
Or how about maybe an era?
Early,
where you and the band were gelling very well.
Late 80s and early 90s. There's, you know, the joy, the excitement, the real magic of the Grateful Dead was so much more in evidence in the early days. And when I felt that I didn't have anything that I could do with that, which is so stupid, so incredibly stupid. But anyway, and then as I was able to do more, I really had more fun lighting them. But then they got a little, you know, it was becoming difficult for them for various reasons.
How about favorite color?
Turquoise, some kind of turquoise, greeny turquoise.
Member of the Grateful Dead that would be the best LD?
Well, I think it possibly could be Phil, Jeff Cimenti. I think he would be a good lighting designer.
Any particular reason?
Because he's so totally tuned into the big picture. He's more outward looking.
Cheetos or Doritos?
Neither one. In a major way, neither one.
Band you would have worked for if you had to go back in time and pick a different band?
I would like to have worked for I would like to light the Shostakovich shows and the Stravinsky shows. Band that I would like, Albert Collins.
Okay, Bobby's Short Shorts. The worst, great for their time, or I wish they were shorter?
You know, one time I gave the all the girls in the front few rows. I gave them all these fancy lacy bras. And the idea was to throw them at Bob when he was doing a tune. And they did. And I said, well, so Bob, what did you think? And he said, about what? And I said, they were all throwing panties at you. And he said, oh, I didn't even notice they do that all the time. But anyway, now, Bob, what about Bob? I didn't like to do jokes on them. Oh, God. Yes. Like one time. No. Okay. I'm digressing.
It's okay. The dead were doing
a long time ago, Not Fade Away. And for some reason I knew they were going to play that on, I guess, one of the nights in this run. So I had, not sure what these things are called, but it's a little cannon with a firework in it that just goes boom, really loud, and smoke comes out of it. And so I had those downstage left and right. And I didn't tell anyone in the band that I was doing this. So except the drummers. I don't know why. Oh, because one of those flash pots, I think they were called, was near the drum. One of them was back behind them. So I just told them and not anybody else. And there's that perfect cue for, flash pots in that tune. There's a few of them. And so I did that. And everybody jumped. And they just went right on playing, and there didn't seem to be any problem with it, and it was a great addition. I would like to have done it every time. And then afterwards, nobody said a word to me about it. Nothing. Nothing at all. So I don't know. But yes, I would love to be able to play jokes on the band. And so I had sometimes some things for the spot operators, the trust spot operators, to throw down on the stage, but the time was never right.
Any particular color combinations that you love or go to often?
Pale yellow, like a Naples yellow, and greenish turquoise. I like that. What do I go to often? I go to that fucking magenta.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't even like magenta.
No, I'm the same way. Yeah. Do you have any that you steer clear of? Like for me, I don't like green and red together. Very saturated green and red.
Oh, well, yeah. But if you want to get just intense and yes, no, I don't like it. Yeah, I would definitely steer clear of those. And of course, pink and blue would be horrible. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's anything else that's off the...
Sure. I think I can guess this one, but do you have a favorite Grateful Dead keyboard player?
I like the way Garcia played behind Pigpen, because he would play some real blues. And that's something I really missed. When Pigpen went, the blues just stopped. I think I really liked Brent... because he was so passionate about his work. You know, he really meant everything he said and did out there. It was beautiful. So I guess I liked his playing. I like them all.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Favorite venue to light?
I liked the place... that Fish are going to a lot now, the place in Vermont. I think we only did, I think the Dead's first show there was in 95. And it's a stadium show. Well, it's not a stadium, but it's an outdoor show. Okay. It doesn't ring a bell.
It does, but they don't play there anymore. Fish doesn't play there anymore. What's that place called?
I thought I read that they were coming back there.
I feel like, I think they're too big.
But that's true. Yeah. Now that used to be a problem with the Grateful Dead. There used to be just too many people coming to the shows.
Yeah. The infrastructure is tough for them.
Yeah. And so I remember that we decided to.
Was it Highgate?
Highgate. Very good. Yeah.
Highgate. Google. Yeah. Highgate. Yeah. You guys played there in 95, 94.
Yeah. Yeah. It was nice. It was kind of huge. And they had. Anyway, I like that. And I like I prefer outdoor venues, I guess.
Purple or violet?
Purple.
Favorite green room snack?
Ooh, it's been too long. Apple pie.
Apple pie, nice. Do you surf?
No.
Okay, and what, do you have a favorite Hawaiian pastime?
Gardening.
Gardening, great. Tie-dye, love it or leave it?
Both. It used to, it's fine. It's just too much of it, that's all.
Do you like lighting it?
It's hard to...
Like as backdrops?
No, and I had to do that once because, I won't go into this, but anyway... you have to have lighting surfaces have to be kind of a little on the pale side. And sometimes I didn't do that. And, but then, or I would have something kind of bright and garish in the daytime, then it would open up and be more paler, but it is better. I liked better when we were doing, even with video, when your lighting surface is with wiggly lights too. To have a surface that's already got some pattern on it, just not much, but I prefer that to the white, to a white projection surface. Those are just kind of deadly.
Okay, if you had to choose one color of the rainbow to never use again, what would it be?
Bright yellow.
Do you have a favorite city or cities to visit on tour?
For some reason, I always like Atlanta, Chicago, New York, New York, because I'm an old stomping ground.
Were you born and raised?
No,
near New York.
No, near Chicago, suburb of Chicago.
Oh, okay. So you just moved for school and adventures?
Yeah, I know. I got to New York just wondering what the hell I was going to do. And it was very easy in those days because there were jobs. So if you get there in like 67 or something, there's jobs. You just go get a job.
Nice.
Not like now.
Yeah, sure.
So I had no idea what I was going to do. Well, I think when I got to New York, I thought I was going to be a set designer. That's right. And then that turned out not to work out for me because to me, some of these dances, I did some dance lighting. And it was a little too obscure. I didn't know exactly what the choreographer was after with some of these things. And I suspect that there's a lot of designers that don't. But I thought that's what made me give up on that. I was like, this requires too much intelligence and organization.
Do you have a favorite post-show libation or beverage?
A shot of cognac with the water back. Well, but that's way back when. Now? After show. Well, I don't know, whatever Paul came up with.
How about if you had a time machine that holds a semi's worth of modern gear, what would one concert, I guess we kind of already talked about this, but what one concert would you travel back in time to light?
Well... Woodstock.
Woodstock, nice. Would you like the Dead or would somebody else?
No, the Dead. The Dead. I can't remember. I should play that sometime. They kind of died at Woodstock, I think. They didn't play.
I heard it was not a good performance from their own mouths. It seems they
did. Yeah, I don't even remember. I was there, but I wasn't doing lighting. Chip was doing lighting, but the lighting system didn't work. It was not practical for. There's an example of an outdoor show where people didn't know how to prepare for an outdoor show. But Woodstock, and because it would be so much fun to have that huge audience and all that bad weather to project, to project into. You know, some places the weather, like Chicago, is really nice because it gets that nice fog at night. I really like that. Mm-hmm.
Natural haze.
Yeah, nothing like it.
Did you ever spend much time in the parking lot scene?
Nope. I didn't.
Okay. Do you have a favorite painter?
Oh, Gauguin. My husband first, and then Gauguin. Larry Lovett, and then Paul Gauguin.
Does Larry have a website I can plug?
He's on Facebook, and now he's into my Facebook, and all hell is broken loose. And he's very interesting on Facebook. He got thrown off because he was being a little too pornographic. And and twice, dear, was that twice?
Yeah. Gauguin would have gotten thrown off.
Gauguin would have gotten thrown off, too. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, you mean with his painting? Yeah.
No, no, I'm saying that my husband, we're very proud that he's been thrown off twice.
Nice.
Yes, so that's where you can see that. Yes, favorite painter, right.
Do you have a favorite, both Grateful Dead and Widespread Panic song, both to light and to listen to?
No, I don't actually. Isn't that strange?
No, it's not strange at all.
Definitely not, because in both cases, you didn't know, can't remember, did they? Did I have a set list? I guess I did have a set list. But there's so many tunes, and Widespread just, you know, they'll cover everybody, especially on New Year's Eve. It just goes, and so I actually didn't. I don't. I hate to say this, but I liked them all.
Yeah, all your children are your favorite. Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Noodling, I find. Noodling, I would like to, you know. Noodling gets old because you wind up using all these cute little things you've figured out to do that, and you sort of run through all those cute little things you just programmed, and then you got the rest of it. You know, noodling...
I definitely find that having structure is easier to light.
Yeah, and also the little bit of structure that Widespread had, that works fine. But when you get into noodling, I don't know, I feel like just putting be back soon, out to lunch, be back soon, or something. Anyway, yeah. I don't like it. Sure. I don't like it. I mean, I enjoy doing it, but it uses up, like when you use video, have you noticed how fast all your video stuff that you've accumulated, you can like go through it in one, two.
Just go right through it.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. One drum space and you're out of content.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. So I'm not crazy about that, but it does make for the suspense, which was a big part of the Grateful Dead. It's how are they going to play this? And is this going to be fabulous? Or is it just going to be kind of dull?
Well, Candace, thank you so much for doing the show. I wish you all the best. Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners?
If you're not really having fun doing lighting, then you're doing something wrong. You should have fun. When we get to do our things that we do well, painting, dancing, whatever it is, we're so lucky. I just feel so lucky that I was able to do that because it was a complete accident. And I'm just so grateful that I stumbled into that when I did and was able to do it for so long and to gradually have a really fabulous lights rig.
You've been listening to the Light Side Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Stratton. You can find us on lukestrattondesigns.com. But before we go, you know, there was one rumor that I really needed to settle with Peter Shapiro before I let him get off the phone. So I asked him, can you settle once and for all the rumor that the rainbow at Fare Thee Well, the double rainbow, was manufactured in some way?
Oh. Yeah, it was made by a man named Jerry Garcia made it.